Khashoggi was killed and his body dismembered at the behest of bin Salman in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. The UN has reacted to the CIA report, saying the US fails to take practical steps to hold the main culprit accountable.
With the release of the U.S. report confirming Saudi officials' culpability at the highest levels, the United States should now take the lead in ensuring accountability for this crime and for setting in place the international mechanisms to prevent and punish such acts in the future. The United States government should impose sanctions against the Crown Prince as it has done for the other perpetrators, targeting his personal assets but also his international engagements.
Reactions are also pouring in from other authorities and legal experts who have dismissed the U.S. report as too little, too late.
This is not enough. The Crown Prince needs to face accountability. He needs to face sanctions, asset freezes, travel bans.
Analysts are also criticizing the White House for failing to take the Saudi Crown Prince to account.
Nobody saw the actual report until now. And yes, it's confirmed that indeed, as the Saudis say, a rogue operative was responsible. And that rogue is bin Salman himself.
Many believe Washington's failure to hold bin Salman accountable is due to its interests. Even the U.S. itself has admitted that it is seeking its own interests in maintaining a close partnership with Riyadh.
I would say the relationship with Saudi Arabia is an important one. We have significant ongoing interests. We remain committed to the defense of the kingdom. And so what we've done by the actions that we've taken is really not to rupture the relationship, but to recalibrate it.
In fact, decades-old U.S.-Saudi nexus have benefited the both, with Riyadh spending its petrodollars for American arms and Washington hatching plots to destabilize the region for its own sake. The U.S. backing for the Saudi regime's deadly mayhem in Yemen over the past 5 years is part of such plots. If the new U.S. administration claims that it really wants to break with the policies of the Trump government, it should walk the walk rather than talk the talk and stop supporting the al-Saud regime that has a long history of malign disregard for not only its own citizens like Khashoggi, but even the impoverished people like Yemenis.
The racial disparities in who gets a dose of the desperately wanted coronavirus vaccine continues to roil the United States. African Americans compose 12% of the U.S. population, yet they have only received 5% of the vaccines. 60% of America is white, and they have gotten 60% of the vaccines. The mainstream media is repeatedly blaming the problem on African Americans by emphasizing their mistrust of the federal government due to a shocking national history of medical experimentation on black communities. However, the small share of whites and blacks who say they refuse to ever get vaccinated is the same, 14%. Multiple studies point to a simpler explanation. Vaccines are overwhelmingly being sent to white neighborhoods. In the United States, vaccines are being issued at places like pharmacies, clinics, and hospitals. But perpetual underinvestment in lower class and non-white areas means many black communities simply don't have this medical infrastructure. Similarly, African American and poor neighborhoods don't have adequate schools, roads, businesses, work opportunities, and many other basic requirements for healthy living. Since almost the start of the pandemic, it's been clear that non-whites are drastically overrepresented in the so-called essential worker occupations, and that non-whites are 4 times more likely to be hospitalized by corona and 3 times more likely to die from it.
And then we also have a lot of our Southside hospitals that are closing and can't meet the demand if they were to get the shipments. They don't have anywhere to store them. So that's another reason. A lot of our clinics are being closed in the inner communities. It's time to get the boots on the ground. It's time to show faith by coming into the black communities, setting up pop-up shops for vaccines.
Latino Americans are getting only 11% of vaccines, despite being 18% of the population. The failure to equally share coronavirus vaccines with all classes is expected to further exacerbate the nation's long-standing socioeconomic inequalities which the pandemic continues to reveal. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Like millions of other young people in the EU, Charles Prevost feels he has not been given adequate support by authorities during the pandemic. In order to survive, the entrepreneur has purchased his own hot dog stand, which he operates in Brussels.
I was working on a restaurant. I was managing a restaurant and I lost my job and I was like, what I can do? What I can do next? What we can do? What the young people, the young men, the young ladies in this world, in this city, in this country, what they can do, because we don't have any help.
As businesses continue to fold in the EU and millions lose their jobs, people feel there is no hope. Only 6.4% of the bloc's population have received a vaccine. That's tiny compared to the UK and US. A two-day video conference involving EU leaders has just concluded. They are very concerned about COVID-19 mutations.
The B117 is by now in all member states but one. The South African variant is in 14 member states and the Brazilian variant in 7. So there's a lot of challenge ahead of us.
Variants are allowed to flourish when people are not vaccinated. Experts say the bureaucratic structures of the EU have resulted in citizens having to wait far too long for vaccines. However, EU leaders say producers are not keeping their promises in terms of supply.
We want more predictability and transparency to ensure that pharmaceutical companies comply with their commitments.
Health officials warn mixed messages from EU leaders about the efficacy of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine are making citizens reluctant to take the jab. Two other vaccines have been approved here, but supply remains a big problem. A fourth vaccine from Johnson & Johnson is likely to be approved next month. During their summit, EU leaders talked at length about the importance of developing certificates to show people have been vaccinated in order to open up travel. Commentators are describing this as laughable, saying it is putting the cart before the horse, given the current state of play with respect to the rollout of vaccines. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Rome's Association of Palestinians called a sit-in in the vicinity of the Italian parliament to draw attention on Israel's COVID-19 vaccine program, which excludes the nearly 5 million Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza Strip under Israeli military occupation. The rally was supported by a number of left-wing groups and unions.
The fourth Geneva Convention stipulates that Israel has a responsibility as an occupying power to ensure that medical aid reaches the occupied territories to combat the coronavirus crisis. Responsibilities also include providing vaccines in a non-discriminatory manner to Palestinians under its control.
Israel has the duty to provide COVID vaccines to Palestinians. The question is why nobody talks about it here in Italy. TVs and newspapers praise Israel's vaccination campaign, but they don't say a word about how Israel is a militarized country which is not observing its international obligations and pays each vaccine dose double the price, promising pharmaceutical companies patient data.
While Palestinians' right to health care is undermined, Tel Aviv has pledged to send thousands of spare coronavirus vaccines to foreign allies that have accepted Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem, such as Czech Republic, Hungary and Honduras.
These vaccine donations are the latest example of Israel's new expression of soft power. Tel Aviv rewards or sways those that have little access to vaccines in exchange for their complicity. This confirms the absence of morals and values of Israel.
We are calling on Italy, the EU and international community to take concrete measures to force Israel to provide Palestinians with vaccines. We are not begging, we demand what is ours.
In January, the United Nations voiced its concern over Israel's refusal to vaccinate the Palestinians, but the appeal has gone unheard so far. Max Civili, Rome.
Across South Korea, vaccinations against COVID-19 began, with more than 5,000 nursing home residents and care providers scheduled to get their jabs by the end of the day.
I was thinking of the elderly patients at our nursing home who have been exhausted and sad about not being able to see their families, so I'm glad to be the first person to be vaccinated. I hope herd immunity is established so that our patients can see their families and everyone can return to daily life without masks.
President Moon Jae-in observed people getting their shots, seeking to encourage people to be vaccinated when it's their turn. South Korean officials say the country should achieve herd immunity by November of this year. Herd immunity is achieved when a high percentage of people have been immunized, preventing the spread of a contagious disease. But about half of South Koreans surveyed are hesitant to get their shots. South Korea had been successful in limiting the spread of COVID-19 during the initial outbreak a year ago, but has seen waves of the virus infect hundreds of people each day since November last year.
There are many reasons why I will get my shot right away, but I think during the last year of COVID-19, the government has done well to prevent it spreading, so I trust them in terms of the vaccine.
South Korea has received vaccines, but I'm hesitant to get it. It's because in the UK, many cases of side effects have been reported, so I'm a bit reluctant. I want to watch what happens, and I'll get it if it's okay then.
Seoul's November goal of herd immunity may also be complicated by supply chain challenges and drug-resistant variants of COVID-19, with a return to normality more likely in 2022. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The nursery home in the vicinity of Tehran, and people are waiting to receive the first dose of their COVID-19 jab. At this phase, which is the second, the elderly and those with underlying diseases and the disabled will get the vaccine. The country's health minister, Said Namaki, attended the retirement home in Kahrizak to launch the campaign. He told reporters that these people will be vaccinated free of charge.
Fortunately, today the second phase of corona vaccination began across the country. At this stage, in addition to people working at the ICUs of the hospitals and the more vulnerable ones, the elderly will get the jab. We launched the campaign here at Kahrizak Nursery Home, but as of tomorrow, at most of the nursery centers, this will continue.
Press TV asked the minister when the normal people will take the vaccine, and he answered that hopefully by September, most of the Iranians will be vaccinated.
Based on the priorities, first off the healthcare staff and then the elderly and people with specific diseases, as well as those injured during the Iran-Iraq war, will be inoculated. Afterwards, it comes to the normal people, and I think most of the target groups will get the shot by mid-September.
We also interviewed the head of Iran's welfare organization, who told us that in the first stage, some 20,000 doses will be allocated to nursery centers across the country.
Over 14,000 elderly people are receiving services at nursery homes across Iran. Out of them, over 3,000 were infected, but some 2,200 got well, 506 people are under treatment, and unfortunately, 375 ones lost their lives despite our efforts. At this center, 1,400 aged and disabled people will be vaccinated within 2 days.
The Islamic Republic kicked off the first phase of COVID-19 vaccination with administering the jab on medical staff working at some 600 hospitals across the country. Iranian health officials say indigenously produced shots will be used in the later stages of the campaign. Over 110,000 people have been vaccinated up to now. Iran has so far logged more than 1.6 million COVID-19 cases with over 59,800 deaths.
Iran began its COVID-19 vaccination program on February 9th. The top priority group of vaccination are doctors and nurses who are working at intensive care units of the hospitals. The next group are these elderly people and the ones with underlying diseases. Human Abedi, Kahrizak.
Venezuela's Congress, also known as the National Assembly, has requested the government of President Nicolas Maduro to expel European Union Ambassador Isabel Brulianti out of the South American nation as a diplomatic action countering the recently launched sanctions from the EU against the Bolivarian Republic. The Maduro administration has denounced the European measures, describing them as illegal and harmful to the economy of Venezuela. Venezuelan officials say that the EU, along with the U.S. government, are plotting to produce a humanitarian crisis in the Latin American country in order to bring down President Nicolas Maduro. Although a UN human rights envoy recently declared foreign sanctions on Venezuela have no legal basis and must be lifted, the EU has ratified its decision. Venezuelan authorities claim they will legally confront the sanctions.
Okay, van 34 meses.
The EU, just like the US, is criminally targeting Venezuela. However, this unfair aggression will not oust Maduro.
Meanwhile, in the opposition, some say elections in Venezuela would ease the elimination of sanctions.
If free elections were held here, all foreign sanctions would blow over, but Maduro refuses to do so.
Nonetheless, socialists insist that neither the EU nor the US can judge what free elections are.
We have already had free elections guaranteed by many foreign observers, so the EU and the US are lying for political purposes.
Caracas slams the EU over violating international law with illegal sanctions. The expelling of the European ambassador is widely seen as a response to the bloc's economic policies against Venezuela. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
This is a specialized meeting on the latest studies on the coronavirus. Organized and hosted by Bacayatullah University, the event brought together epidemiologists, virologists, and other medical experts to present their team's latest findings on prevention and treatment of COVID-19.
We tried the so-called plasmapheresis in treating COVID-19 patients. What is plasmapheresis? It's a method of removing blood plasma from the body and re-injecting it into the bloodstream. We conducted this method on 28 COVID patients, and it was effective so far. We need to gather a large sample to achieve more reliable results.
We conducted a single-centered retrospective observational study of 60 laboratory-confirmed COVID patients and administered low-dose prednisolone in combination with naproxen and lopinavir. This helped reduce the length of patients' hospitalization.
Since the pandemic broke out in Iran, Bagayatullah University has dedicated its R&D centers to COVID-related projects. So far, it has launched 200 research projects that seek to find a way to tackle the pandemic. Among them is a recombinant-based COVID vaccine that is making its way to the human trial phase.
We are wrapping up the animal trial stage and will soon begin the human trials of our vaccine. Our university has become a hotspot of major projects that center on COVID-19. We were amongst the first center that proposed plasma therapy for COVID-19. We're also conducting research on stem cell therapy and other viable treatments for the novel disease.
With the Bagayatullah vaccine, Iran now possesses three viable candidates that have made their way to the human trial: COVPARS, which is a recombinant vaccine, and COVIran, which works based on a weakened coronavirus. This, as Iran has already started its mass inoculation program using Russia's Sputnik V.
Bagayatullah Hospital has since day one been one of the most active places in the fight against COVID-19. Now, as many biotech firms are concentrating their efforts on prevention and vaccine development, this center has also paid attention to treatment. Researchers here say they're very close to an effective COVID medicine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Almost 1 year after the first positive case of COVID-19 was confirmed in Afghanistan, the country has now launched its first COVID-19 vaccination campaign. Representatives of medics, Afghan armed troops and journalists are the first ones who will receive doses of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine donated earlier this month by India.
Today I congratulate the people of Afghanistan on the launch of the first stage of COVID-19 vaccination. This is a big opportunity for the people of Afghanistan. I request all government bodies, media, and our religious scholars to cooperate with each other to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign smoothly.
Afghanistan received 500,000 doses of AstraZeneca's vaccine from the Serum Institute of India, which is producing the vaccine for mid- and low-income countries, earlier this month. The spread of COVID-19 in Afghanistan hardly hit the Afghan society due to mismanagement and lack of medical equipment. However, officials here say the government is committed to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign all over the country.
We don't expect any miracles. We need full collaboration of the entire society. So let's help this campaign to be implemented justly.
Taliban has announced its backing for the vaccination campaign. However, the inoculations comes amid relentless violence despite intra-Afghan talks. As official statistics estimate, up to 10 million Afghans that make nearly a third of the population might have been infected with the coronavirus. Nearly 60,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and over 2,000 deaths have been recorded so far. Afghan officials say the pandemic is still a serious problem for the country and urge health workers to vaccinate the whole nation in a fair and transparent manner. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Iran is a country that is located in one of the most, if not the most, geostrategic regions in the world. It is on the way of the east-west and north-south corridors. Moreover, Iran links Asia to Europe. The Makran waterway has played a significant role in the global trade since centuries ago. Experts maintain that this region is the region of hidden treasures. Makran is located on the way of 2 out of 3 major transit corridors in the world. Access to rich energy resources, control over the most important route of energy and goods transfer in the world, has granted Makran a highly significant status as it connects Central Asia to free waters and also connects Indian subcontinent to Europe, West Asia, and so on. Moreover, the region is suitable for construction and development of vast ports and trade terminals. Furthermore, it has rich capacities of tourist attractions. Dr. Isa Ebrahimzadeh, an expert in economic development, make it clear that Makran coasts are the only ocean coasts of Iran and can play an important role in economic prosperity due to the location of Chabahar port in it. Direct access to the Indian Ocean has turned the region into a hub of Iran's economic exchanges with global markets. Chabahar, owing to its access to international waters and deep water, is capable of turning into a port for giant container ships to dock on its jetties. As a matter of fact, this has already taken place in the area, and Iranian experts and technicians have built and installed immense facilities in this port. Once the whole projects materialize, the Makran coasts will make billions of dollars and create hundreds of thousands of jobs directly and indirectly. A cursory look shows that Makran region enjoys numerous geographical, commercial, and tourist potentials that can pave the way for putting into effect part of the objectives of the second phase of the Islamic Revolution, highlighted by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in his statement dubbed as second step or second phase. The Islamic Republic of Iran has the capacity to play a more active role in the transportation network of Eurasia and, by putting its potentials into practice, turn into a new pole of the air and rail transportation in West Asia. Iran proposed the formation of a free trade zone, FTZ, with the Eurasian Economic Union, EAEU, in 2016. The proposal was welcomed by member states. Thus, after 2 years of talks, an agreement was inked on May 17, 2018, in the Kazakh city of Astana. Due to the high diversity of the market and resources in the EAEU member states, joining to the Union can create remarkable opportunities for Iran's economy. One of the privileges of this membership is that it connects Iran to a 180 million-strong market and boosts the country's exports. Russia itself will create a big market for Iran with 140 million population. The EAEU enables Iran to have access to the transit routes of the two sides of the Caspian Sea, and also will give the other member states access to the market in the Persian Gulf and even Africa. The North-South Corridor links Mumbai in India to St. Petersburg in Russia. This route is going to turn into the most important commercial course in the world in the coming years. The route starts in India and then reaches the Sea of Oman and Chabahar and Bandar Abbas ports in south of Iran, then through roads and railways reaches the north of the country on the shores of the Caspian Sea to transit goods to the north, east, and west of the Caspian Sea. The railway enters Astara in Azerbaijan Republic, and the sea route passes through Anzali port of Iran to lead to Astrakhan port of Russia. The Islamic Republic of Iran opened Azvin Rasht Railway 2 years ago, and Rasht Astara course is also being completed in line with this project. Currently, the member states of the North-South Corridor are not limited to India, Iran, Russia, and Azerbaijan Republic. In the south of the country, Oman has also joined the project. In the west and northwest, Turkey, Armenia, Syria, Belarus, Bulgaria, Georgia, and Ukraine have also joined the project. In the northeast too, Tajikistan and Kazakhstan have joined the huge project. Now, Iran's membership of EAEU can significantly boost oil and non-oil exports.
Thank you. The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Well, it has been a year since the Taliban and the United States signed an agreement in Doha, allegedly to bring an end to the 20 years of war in the country. However, it appears that the war is not any closer to ending, and Afghans are continuing to die. The violence has increased during this last year, and it doesn't really seem like American troops will be leaving in May, as they promise in the agreement. Is this another broken American agreement that won't bear any fruit? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this debate.
On February 29th, 2020, the United States and the Taliban signed a peace agreement in Doha, Qatar. Under the deal, which was officially titled the Agreement for Bringing Peace to Afghanistan, it was agreed by the U.S. to withdraw all American and NATO troops from Afghanistan. Taliban also pledged to prevent Al-Qaeda from operating in areas under Taliban control and to hold talks with the Afghan government. The agreement came more than 19 years after the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. It was after the September 11 attacks in 2001 when then-President George W. Bush ordered the invasion.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
American troops entered Afghanistan looking for Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, claiming the government of Afghanistan was sheltering him. They promised to drive out both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda militants. At first, just more than 1,000 U.S. soldiers were sent to Afghanistan. The numbers kept growing every year. While every U.S. government promised to end the war in Afghanistan, the flames of conflict became bigger.
This month, our combat mission in Afghanistan will be over. Our war in Afghanistan is coming to a responsible end.
I can tell you, after 19 years, we'd like to bring our young people back home.
The U.S. Central Command Combined Air Operations Center says the U.S. Air Force dropped a record number of 7,423 bombs on Afghanistan. More than 100,000 Afghans have been killed or wounded since 2009, when the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan began documenting casualties. After nearly two decades, the U.S. invasion has achieved very little. Violence still rages on in Afghanistan, with thousands of people getting killed each year. Washington did not manage to drive out the Taliban. Instead, the militant group now controls much of the country. 20 years of bloodshed amid what the U.S. government insisted to call nation building did not produce the political results Washington was after. That's why they stretched their hand to the Taliban for peace. American troops invaded Afghanistan to drive out the Taliban, but instead, we're forced to recognize them. The Doha peace agreement shows that America finally accepted the fact that Afghanistan's fate was never going to be determined by them. Afghans choose what's best for them without the help of foreigners.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition out of San Francisco, and Ian Williams, Senior Analyst, Foreign Policy in Focus, out of New York. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start it off in San Francisco. And Richard, do you think the Doha Agreement accomplished anything for Afghanistan?
Well, it doesn't appear so. It doesn't appear that the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan, which I must say, really didn't start almost 20 years ago. It started 42 years ago, in July of 1979, when President Carter signed a directive authorizing U.S. intervention against the new government, the revolutionary government in Afghanistan. And that was testified to in 1998 by Carter's National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, of all people, and also by Robert Gates, who former CIA director. So, you know, 42 years, Afghanistan has been devastated by these U.S. interventions, the two rounds of them, and what went on in between. And the U.S. leadership and the Pentagon in particular are opposed to a withdrawal now. And they don't see a way out, and so they want to continue the longest war in history longer and longer and longer into the future.
Well, Ian, the Afghan government was made to free 5,000 Taliban prisoners after the U.S. agreed to that, but the rest of the agreement has not been implemented. Your take on this aspect of the agreement and possible effects of freeing these prisoners?
Possible effects are there's 5,000 people out there who are armed and very upset with the Afghan government. Remember, the Afghan government, which we claim was elected and is a democratic representation of the people in Afghanistan, was not included in those negotiations. And that's been one of the problems, is that the decisions have been made about Afghanistan with very little relevance, and certainly even less consultation for the people of Afghanistan. It's been great power reasons. Carter didn't oppose the original government in Afghanistan for any particular reasons, apart from the fact that it was pro-Soviet at the time. And the US was in a Cold War against the Soviet Union, so it supported the enemies. Those enemies, as it turned out, to be the ancestors of the warlords and the Taliban. They were armed by the US, once again, with no thought for the welfare of the Afghan people. Remember, 9/11 at the time, it was blowback. It was the fact that we had poured weapons and treasure and support to fairly vicious, evil people in that area, because they were anti-Soviet, evil, vicious people, which made it okay. So this has been the pattern right from the beginning. Since then, of course, they've just wanted to extricate themselves. And the problem is that the government in Afghanistan is weak and unsupported. It's corrupt. It's been corrupted in part because there's loads of cash floating around from NATO and from the US and others, and from the opium and other trades that the US condoned because their allies depended on it. So, you know, there's loads of ways to go wrong and not many ways to go straight forward. One of them has got to be that we refused to speak to the Taliban because they were Al-Qaeda. Mm. Now, not speaking to the US, to the Afghan government is almost as bad. But in the end, the Taliban, whether you like them or not, as has often been said, tritely perhaps, you don't make peace with friends, you make peace with enemies. So nobody's been prepared to negotiate until recently on a straightforward basis with the Taliban. When Trump did it with particular, you know, Trumpian efficiency, he neglected to include his own so-called allies in the negotiations and didn't do so for their benefit. He did it so that he could declare victory and get the hell out of there in time for the election. So, you know, it's once again, the real pattern here is people outside Afghanistan making decisions that are not in the interests and do not consult people in Afghanistan.
Right.
It's a dreary situation. But until that part is addressed, there's unlikely to be any way out.
Well, Richard, you know, violence in Afghanistan took almost 6,000 civilian lives in 2020 alone. Now, the U.S. and its allied troops have been in Afghanistan, well, as you said, even prior to the 20 years, but we're talking about since 9/11, 2001, 20 years. Why is there still so much instability and violence in that country that American troops now have been there for decades?
Well, it's really a product of occupation, above all. I mean, the Taliban is obviously, anyone who looks at its program and its history knows that it's not a progressive organization, but it's an Afghan organization. It's made up of people from Afghanistan, and it has waged this war against the U.S. It looked like they were completely destroyed, completely defeated, back in 2001. After the October 2001 invasion of Afghanistan, the bombing, the taking of thousands and thousands of prisoners, the torture that went on, the executions that went on. But that turned out not to be the case. As an organization that was resisting the occupation, they now, as your other guest, Mr. Williams, said, you know, they now control very large parts, some say three-quarters of the country. The United States has no interest, and as your other guest also pointed out, in the welfare of the Afghan people. This has gone on for a long time. Just to reference again what Brzezinski said, he said, in his interview, and this was 3 years before 2001, that the U.S. could give the USSR its Vietnam War. Imagine thinking that. What kind of a person thinks that, gee, that would be a great thing to do for a people, for a country, to have a Vietnam-style war where millions of people are killed and the country is poisoned and all of that death and destruction? But that was the U.S. Wish at that time. When the USSR withdrew, the Afghan government did not immediately collapse. I believe it lasted for 3 to 4 more years. And then there was a period of intense civil war with a great deal of horror involved in it. The U.S. had no interest at all in trying to resolve that crisis. And since they went in 2001 and occupied the country, we've seen year after year after year, thousands and thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of casualties among the Afghan people. And I think the record, we have to take the record seriously, that there's no concern for the welfare of Afghanistan involved, and it really has to end. The occupation has to end. We don't know what the future exactly will be, but we know that the future will continue to be like what we've seen over the last 20 years, as long as the occupation lasts.
What about that, Ian, what Richard said? I mean, so obviously the U.S. did not was able to create a stable situation in Afghanistan, and Richard said they really weren't interested in the interests of the Afghan people. Why is the United States then in Afghanistan, in your perspective?
Well, look, it gets even more complicated. Let's remember, the Taliban were prepared to do a deal and hand over al-Qaeda in term for survival. But George Bush wanted scalps on his belt after 9/11. Remember that the U.S., Afghanistan and al-Qaeda were definitely behind 9/11. The Iraqis certainly weren't. George Bush put hundreds of thousands of troops into Iraq to fight an enemy that wasn't there, and a couple of thousand with the CIA really becoming just another partner in tribal warfare inside Afghanistan. Because the Taliban aren't just an ideological organization.
Okay, well, with that, I mean...
to some extent... Okay.
I lost your voice for a second. Go ahead, Ian. Go ahead. We lost the connection a bit.
Well, I'll try to remember where we came in. The Taliban, as well as being an ideological Islamic organization, an ethnic, a tribal organization, they're Pashtuns, and they have compatriots or co-linguals across in the border in Pakistan who have been supporting them. So all this time, Americans were supporting a Pakistan military government that was also giving aid and comfort to the Taliban, because nobody was able to make the clear distinctions. They were tied up in their ideological prism. So we're supporting Pakistan. We're supporting the Pakistan military, which, as we saw, acted as host for Osama bin Laden. And if anyone thinks that they didn't know he was there, then I have a bridge to sell you here in the East River in Washington, in New York. It is a complicated battle. And the U.S., once again, wasn't really there. It was for the Afghans. They supported a group of corrupt warlords against the Taliban. Those warlords are still in control. They use them as the proxies for their battle. I mean, they didn't even do an honest job of colonialism when going in, occupying it and reforming. They trusted it to local surrogates who were proven incompetent and corrupt. And that's the legacy that we now have. I mean, it's no good, it's like the old joke of people asking for directions and being told, if I were you, I wouldn't start from here. There really is not a clear way out, but we do know where the mistakes have made, and we know the attitudes that led to those mistakes. And it comes back to what we've, I think, both been saying from the beginning, is a complete disregard for the welfare of the Afghans, and putting, first of all, not even the geopolitical considerations of the United States, but as in the case of Trump and George W. Bush, the internal political considerations of the United States at a higher level than millions of people dying and suffering in the rest of the world.
Well, Richard, what about now? So Ian says even sometimes domestic politics inside the United States that caused the American presidents to make the decisions that they did dealing with Afghanistan. What about now? We have a new U.S. administration. We saw from last year the agreement that took place under the Trump administration that actually they're supposed to be taking troops, American troops are supposed to be leaving Afghanistan in May. Tell me what you think about this new administration. Will it adhere to the agreement, the Doha agreement, or your assessment of it all?
Well, we don't have a crystal ball, but I would say that based on knowing who Joe Biden is and who he has surrounded himself with, his Secretary of State, his National Security Advisor, the leadership in the Pentagon, you know, I think it's very doubtful that will take place. And you know, it's not just Biden, it's not just up to Biden, although Biden himself is a neocon. I mean, there's a great relief in the much of the world that Trump's gone. But, you know, we have today, even in the lead-in here, you know, them saying, the Biden administration saying that they bombed Syria in self-defense. I mean, that's amazing. That's an amazing statement. And I don't think Biden is inclined to buck the Pentagon. The Pentagon does not want to withdraw all the troops. They made that very clear.
Well,
and I think that
why is that the case, Richard? Let me stop you right there. Sorry to interrupt you. Why is that the case? On the one hand, we've been talking back and forth how it's become this quagmire and the United States really wants to leave but can't find a way out. Why does the U.S. want to stay in Afghanistan?
Well, I think that there are internal political considerations, and those that is, you know, to whoever does the final withdrawal will be subject to the allegations that they abandoned Afghanistan and, you know, all the troops who were killed and all the money that was spent, it was all for nothing because the U.S. lost. But the other is that, you know, the Afghanistan with the U.S. out and with the Taliban government, I don't think is going to be an ally of the United States. And the United States has stitched together, you know, a worldwide a coalition, willing and unwilling, of allies and partners in the interest of the U.S. empire. So, you know, that's a consideration as well. So there are both domestic and foreign policy considerations that are at play there.
In the interest of U.S. empire, what about that, Ian? I mean, how much of this 20 years, at least 20 years at least, that the U.S. has been involved in Afghanistan, what has it done for the U.S. empire?
Well, to begin with, it was part of the great game. It was the same as the British. It was the control of the roof of the world, the entrance to India, entrance to the Middle East. And but that has changed. You know, the British got out of India in the end, or pushed out of India. And things came back to rest. The Soviets have gone. And the Russian involvement, apart from being a gadfly to annoy the Americans, is not really serious. There are other players like China there who are looming but aren't yet in. But the real issue, I think, look, we have to give some credence here. It's difficult looking at the quagmire, but there are people in the United States who really feel an obligation. They can't abandon the women and the Democrats and the others in Afghanistan to the Taliban. We've seen what happens. They go out assassinating women judges. They go out assassinating women who take professions. So the liberal conscience would be deeply disturbed if the U.S. pulls out and leaves those people to their fate. The U.S. military, yes, they have not played an honorable role, but they do have military comradeship. They've been fighting alongside Afghan soldiers. And the idea that you can just abandon them and leave them, it's hard for them. So it's a difficult decision for a president to make. We can all say that there should be no occupation. There should be no foreign troops in there. But on the other hand, how do you go about it? Do you just go out and leave total chaos? Do you just go out and leave these people to their fate? Or do you do it in some phased way?
Well,
do you negotiate?
Well, Ian, let me just jump in here. Let me just jump in here. Ian, do you think that the United States has added to this chaos? Or do you think that the United States being there has helped control the chaos?
The United States started the chaos. The United States was the initial, you know, stir of the pot. It poured all of the herbs, the poisonous herbs in the kept the pot boiling. So, yes, they're responsible. But, you know, I don't know how to put it. If you've started a house fire and you're in a position to try to put it out, do you just rush out and say, I can't do anything now. Now let's just burn it. So if you break it, you own it. I think that is the feeling in the more responsible part of the U.S. There's others who just want payback, you know.
Okay.
They hate the Taliban, but they're Muslims, we get them. But it's not going to be easy. Whatever Biden does is going to be wrong.
Stay with me, Ian. I'm running out of time. Stay with me. Let me get Richard back in on this. Richard, your take. You heard what Ian said. The liberal consciousness of the United States. That's part of it. Your assessment of this, because you had actually touched on something earlier when we were talking about that liberal consciousness, and we see this new Biden administration, who you rightly pointed out bombed Syria and said it was in self-defense. So let's talk about that so-called liberal consciousness, and what does it mean for Afghans, more than 20 years of this country and their country being occupied?
Well, I think that there are those factors that are involved, and there are those who feel that way about, you know, pulling out and leaving behind a bad situation with the reactionary, what would become a very reactionary government appear to be. But I don't think that's the main factor here. I think that, you know, we have to look at it from the point of view of empire, and that a government that is hostile to the United States and Afghanistan is a factor in terms of the United States' two main enemies in the area, or who they're focusing on as enemies, and that is China, with which Afghanistan shares a small border, and Iran, with which Afghanistan shares a very large border. And even though there are great differences in the ideology and the outlook of the leaders of those of Iran and China and what would become a new government in Afghanistan, they nevertheless are all Iran and China being targeted by the United States, there's a possibility that the U.S. position in the entire region could be greatly weakened. And I think that more than anything else is what concerns the Pentagon and the foreign policy establishment in the United States.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Out of San Francisco from the Answer Coalition, Mr. Richard Becker. And out of New York, senior analyst, Foreign Policy and Focus, Mr. Ian Williams. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi.